Indie Comics. Indie Comics.
Today, Steve and I are going to be talking about the X-Men, created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby way back in 1963. But this is not a small discussion, and we actually had to break it into two parts to make sure that we covered everything and that the episode wasn't 2 hours long. In this episode, we're going to talk about the comics and the video games, as well as the X-Men, the animated series. In the next episode, we're going to cover the movies and various animated and live-action series. But as you are the bigger X-Men fan between us, Steve, why don't you get us started?
Oh, awesome. The X-Men were a huge formative part of my life, and it was the book that made me a Marvel fan. I was lucky enough to come in when the X-Men was starting to catch on, so it's something that I have a particular fondness for. This is a concept that is so accessible, and if you've ever felt like an outcast at any time, this is a book that speaks to you. A lot of people today came in with the 90s animated series or the films, and we'll talk about those for sure, but for me, this is where it was at. How did you discover the X-Men, Mike?
I guess it was around the mid to late 80s. I suppose it was really FOMO that got me initially to pick it up. The book, especially Wolverine, was really popular at my local comic book shops in Chico, and I wanted to see what everyone was talking about. Wolverine, however, quickly became my favorite character back then. I liked the anti-hero tough guys that became so popular in the 90s. But to be fair, I quit reading comics in 1994, so I didn't get to see the concept run into the ground, as I understand it was. But back in the day, even though I could not afford too many comics, X-Men comics would often make my list. I loved the stories about the mutants and their struggles that often reflected various prejudice-based hatreds and practices. The mutants, both then and now, are often related to by those that, in the words of the great Patti Smith, are outside of society. Those that don't fit in or are rejected because they are different, strange, or weird. I know that I certainly related to them in that fashion when I was a boy and a teenager. I remember being surprised, though, to find out that Iceman from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was a mutant. I never heard of them bring it up on the show, but I thought that was cool.
I suspect many people who grew up on X-Men back in its heyday loved Wolverine. I mean, I know I did. He was just such a fascinating character at the time. I mean, even if he's played out quite a bit since. And I agree on Spidey and His Amazing Friends being a gateway into the X-Men. I remember an episode of that show where the X-Men were guest stars, and Firestar and Iceman went back to the X-Mansion. I did see that episode, and I also remember an issue of a kid's science magazine talking about mutations in the X-Men, complete with art by John Romita Jr. I remember Nightcrawler in particular standing out to me at the time. So after I read Secret Wars, I picked up X-Men 188, and I was pretty much a fan ever since. So why don't we get into what made the X-Men such a huge success, Mike?
I'd be glad to. Many other characters in Marvel, like Spider-Man or Captain America or others, were all made popular over a series of writers and different takes on the characters. But when it comes to the X-Men, their popularity was almost exclusively because of the work of a single writer named Chris Claremont, who took Len Wein and David Cockrum's new international X-Men that was built off of Stan Lee's and Jack Kirby's basic ideas and expanded it into a whole world. And I say world because it in part because the X-Men were mutants. Being mutants were separated from the rest of the heroes in the Marvel Universe, who got their powers by magic or some science experiment or something. And as a reader, they always felt like they were in their own little pocket of the Marvel Universe. But also because he created so many characters in the mutant world. I mean, is that just me, or did it feel like that for you as well, Steve?
Oh, without a doubt, yes. I mean, there's no question that Chris Claremont is the singular voice that made the X-Men what they are today. I don't want to dismiss the previous runs completely because they did provide the building blocks that Claremont picked up and ran with. And there's some good stuff in there, which I will talk about briefly. But Claremont either created or defined most of the X-Men that we know and love today over the course of an unprecedented 17-year run on the X-Books. Claremont also wrote most of what are today are considered the definitive X-Men stories, you know, the ones that have stood the test of time. No other writer has had a run that long on a mainstream Big Two book or had the level of influence that Claremont had on those characters. But before we get into Claremont, I want to talk a little bit about some of the previous stuff. Lee and Kirby had a fairly short run on the X-Men, and it was originally considered a failed experiment for many years. I mean, the original stories focused on the original five X-Men, Cyclops, the Beast, who was still human but looked kind of apish, the Angel with his normal feathered wings, Iceman and Jean Grey, who was just a telekinetic originally. They were under the guidance of Professor Charles Xavier, a powerful telepath who ran a secret boarding school for mutants out of Westchester in New York State. The basic idea of X-Men as a mutant school is one that comes back again and again as new generations of mutants are introduced. The New Mutants, Generation X, and Academy X, to name just a few examples.
You know, part of the reason I wanted to be a mutant as a kid was because of Xavier's School for Gifted Youngsters. It's really a cool part of the mythos, and I'm guessing that's why it's used over and over again.
Yeah, for sure. The idea of mutation as a metaphor for the teenage struggle for acceptance rings true and always has. I mean, Xavier's is like the cool boarding school you always wanted to go to.
Right.
But as an aside, I also strongly suspect that Stan was influenced by pulp science fiction novels. Many of those stories dealt with humans developing psychic powers and the consequences of that. But I think probably the biggest influence on Lee's X-Men was probably Slan by A.E. Van Vogt. That book dealt with an involved race of humans who called the Slan, who was being hunted to extinguish extinction by ordinary humans. And Slan's trying to find peace with them. It's a pretty decent book, but pretty obscure today.
That certainly sounds like sounds a lot like what happens in the X-Men titles. If it was not an influence, the similarities are downright uncanny. And yes, I used that word on purpose.
Stan and Jack were very well read in the literature of their day, for sure. But speaking of uncanny, let's move back to the X-Men. Later on, we see the original X-Men graduate, and Stan and Jack would also graduate to move on to other projects. Roy Thomas wrote the book for a while after that, but it never had the energy that Claremont would later bring to it, except once. And that was towards the end of Thomas's run when Neil Adams took over the art. Thomas and Adams would also be a huge influence on Claremont and Byrne. They brought in ideas like the Savage Land Mutates, the Living Pharaoh, as well as the introduction of Sunfire. I'll also add that Morph from the animated series was based on the shape-shifting mutant Changeling from the Roy Thomas run. Changeling was introduced to bring back Charles Xavier, who had been presumed dead for some time. So Morph took a lot of the elements from that character, but we'll talk about that when we get into the animated series. I think most people generally agree that the Thomas Adams run is probably the best of the pre-Wayne material in X-Men, and I think deservedly so. Now, from there, X-Men had been canceled for a while, but then Marvel wanted to bring it back in a big way. So Len Wein and Brave Cockrum were brought in to create a team of all new, all different X-Men. But this time it would be an international team led by Cyclops. I think the idea was to appeal to a broader audience in other countries that would be reading the book, if I remember Wein correctly on that. So Wein brought in existing characters from the Thomas era like Banshee and Sunfire. He brought in his own character, Wolverine, who he introduced in the Hulk story that he wrote previously. And then the rest he created with Cockrum, though some of those were based on designs that Dave Cockrum had when he drew Legion of Superheroes. Nightcrawler particularly had started as a Legion design, and then Wayne built on that, though it took Claremont to make him the Kurt Wagner we know today. Storm was another design that Cockrum had in mind since Legion, though she's another one that it took Wayne and Claremont to develop later. For my money, I'll say that Cockrum is one of the greatest costume designers of all time. But we'll get into the all-new, all-different team in a little bit. But to get back to Claremont, he pretty much came into the X-Men job out of nowhere. I mean, he started as a gopher with Marvel, mainly through connections that Claremont's family had. Because Claremont's family knew Al Jaffe, who is best known for his work on Mad Magazine. Jaffe had worked in comics before that. He actually knew Stan from the Timely days when he was working on Patsy Walker, and Jaffe was able to get Claremont's foot in the door. So Claremont was able to work his way up to assistant editor, which back then wasn't really like a huge position. And then he did small writing jobs here and there. Eventually, Claremont became Wayne's assistant, and that led him eventually to getting the X-Men gig. But why don't we talk about what Claremont brought to the table as a writer, Mike?
Oh, I'd be glad to, Steve. I find it interesting that Claremont went to college to be an actor, and that influenced how he thought about his characters, because really it's an actor's job to really flesh out a character and make them three-dimensional. This aspect of Claremont's past, I think, is one of the key components to the success of the X-Men, because each of his characters felt distinct and layered. There are no basic 2D characters from him. Each one felt lived in. Granted, relatable characters with flaws and real-life problems was a staple of Marvel since the early 60s. Oftentimes, while there was a great battle going on, the reader was wondering if the fight was going to get over in time for Peter Parker to make the test that day or not miss a date. This made Marvel's characters very accessible, and it seems like with Claremont's past in college, learning about acting, that he was practically handmade to work at Marvel. Honestly, I think Marvel lucked out when they chose to make X-Men a bi-monthly title instead of a quarterly, as Dave Cockrum couldn't do a bi-monthly title, and Len Wein wasn't sure if he could do it either. But what started out as a potentially bad situation left an opportunity for Chris Claremont to volunteer to write the X-Men title.
Oh, this is definitely true. I'll also add that Claremont actively lobbied for the job when Wein announced he was moving on. Back then, nobody wanted to work on the X-Men because the book had been a commercial failure. But Claremont sought opportunity in these characters, and he had ideas for what he wanted to do with the book. Wein eventually realized how much passion Claremont had for the X-Men, and Claremont got the go-ahead to do it. Now, you're right about Claremont's past and drama being a huge part of what worked about his writing, but the other part of it was that Claremont was a political science student, and that gave him the right grounding to talk about the book's socio-political issues. He also took a trip to Israel as a college student, and that was a huge influence on his run. This is partly why you get X-Men as a globe-trotting adventure, but it also influenced Claremont's ideas with Magneto and characters like David Haller. But there were other influences on the 70s X-Men team as well, weren't there, Mike?
There are, but this one is just my opinion. I think that Star Trek, the original series, was an inspiration for the international team of X-Men. I know the story goes that Marvel was making some decent sales internationally, and they figured that if they had a book full of international characters, then it would bring in more sales. But on Star Trek, which started in 1966, almost a decade before Giant Size X-Men number one in 1975, did many of the same kinds of ideas with the crew. Specifically, I'm referring to taking characters from countries that the U.S. was in conflict with, like Pavel Chekhov and Peter Rasputin, aka Colossus. Both were heroes from Russia in American stories during the Cold War. Now, if you weren't there, that might not sound as big as it was, but trust me when I say it was a big deal back then. I would also compare Nyota Uhura and Aurora Monroe, aka Storm. Granted, in 1966, it was a bigger deal to have a black woman in a prominent role on the show, like being one of the members of the bridge crew on the Enterprise, Starfleet's flagship. Or with Storm, she was not only an important part of the team, she even led the team for a while. I would also like to compare Spock and Nightcrawler, both of whom were said to look like demons and or devils at the time they came out, although it's a bit more literal in Nightcrawler's case. But they were, in fact, one of the wisest, most genuinely good people on the team. Demons and devils were so stereotypical back then that they all had the same kind of generic character. So to take a character that you want to associate with that based solely on the character's appearance and then subvert that expectation by making them good and peaceful was a big twist back in the day. It also speaks volumes to the readers, or at least it did for me, about ways that I used to judge people by their appearance, a purely surface feature. For instance, I certainly assumed Nightcrawler was going to be wicked simply because he looked the part.
Right. The brilliance of Nightcrawler came with Claremont, who decided that Kurt wouldn't be what he looked like. Kurt Wagner looks like a devil, but he wasn't one. Claremont's experience with Germans was generally positive, and he wanted to put that into Nightcrawler. So Kurt has the good sense of humor, he has empathy, he's a swashbuckler, and he's a man of faith. And with Spock, too, he looks a bit sinister, but underneath the veneer of cool logic, is a man of unwavering principle and loyalty. Now, I can't speak for Wein, but I think you may be right about the Trek influence in X-Men. I'm certain that Claremont was influenced by Star Trek, though. Claremont usually absorbed everything in science fiction pop culture, and he found a way to create X-Men versions of them. And I can think of several times that Claremont wrote in nods to Star Trek, the original series, especially when the Shi'ar showed up. There's one blink and miss it scene where a Shi'ar ship crew, Shi'ar analogs of the original Star Trek crew, commanded by Captain Kirk, with an apostrophe in the name. And then later, after leaving the X-Men, Claremont wrote a Star Trek graphic novel called Dead of Honor about the original crew, and it makes a ton of references to classic Trek episodes and characters of well in the films, and it's actually pretty good. So there's no question in my mind that Chris Claremont was a huge Star Trek fan, and he knew classic Trek inside and out, so anything he did with that is probably intentional.
Wow, I guess I nailed that on the head. I have to say that makes me like Claremont even more. And that issue with the Shi'ar sounds pretty cool. Unfortunately, though, I basically had to quit reading comics at 16, and I did not get back into them until my early 30s. But before 1994, I remember particularly loving the interactions the X-Men had with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, or just the Brotherhood of Mutants, as they're called now, as led by Magneto. His relationship with Charles and the different perspectives was a big part of the fun. Two totally legitimate ideologies based on an ongoing crisis. Both of them agreed that things were not and haven't been right for mutants for a long time. Both of them agreed that the process of achieving civil rights and equal rights and non-prejudice laws was going to be a long and tedious process that may or may not work. I have on more than one occasion heard that the X-Men were originally a reflection of the actual civil rights movement that went on between 1954 and 1968. In that comparison, I've also heard that Eric Lyncher, aka Magneto, takes the side of using force and violence to achieve his goals of civil rights for mutants by any means necessary. And in that way, he loosely represents Malcolm X. In that same loosely based way, Charles Xavier, aka Professor X, represented the nonviolent resistance path to achieve those same goals. And in that way, he loosely represented Martin Luther King Jr. However, they have both experienced mutant hatred on extremely different levels. Magneto's past is super harsh. I mean, damn. And Magneto is willing to take by force what should be their innate rights, and that eventually turns into a superiority complex over non-mutants. Charles, however, will always take the path of peace whenever possible, and the X-Men are there both to help and to protect both mutants and non-mutants alike when needs be. But he sees the value in the system, however corrupt or difficult it may be. Going through the proper channel shows a willingness to do things their way, and that says a lot against their opponent in the political process, something akin to Superman allowing people to put him in handcuffs. Also, Professor X sees that Magneto's way will only lead to more war and suffering without the legitimacy of the political process having been gone through, and ultimately makes mutants just as bad as those who hate mutants simply for who they are. Both sides are easy to understand. Now, I want to repeat that I said understand and not agree with. Magneto clearly goes off the rails, but he did start off in a very reasonable position.
True. Magneto is a character that has evolved a lot over the years, and that was Claremont's doing. He originally was a card-carrying villain, in fact, though I believe Dan has spoken about the civil rights allegory with Magneto and Xavier. I'm not sure how well thought out it was originally, though, because it didn't have anywhere near the moral ambiguity that Claremont brought to the character later on. I think the idea back then was that Magneto was the X-Men's Dr. Doom, who was a mutant supremacist who would do anything to achieve his goals. Some writers have attempted to bring Magneto back to the Silver Age version, mainly John Byrne and Grant Morrison. But Claremont's vision for Magneto was so strong that any attempts to regress him never stuck. And thankfully for that, too, because Magneto is so much more interesting the way he is now. Interestingly enough, though, Claremont didn't really see Magneto as Malcolm X or anyone like that. He was less interested in the civil rights era and more interested in the parallels with Israel and the Jewish experience. As we've discussed, the trip that Claremont took to Israel was very formative, and it affected how he looked at Magneto. So Claremont saw Magneto as someone like David Ben-Gurion, who was Israel's first prime minister, and his rivalry with Menachem Begin, I believe that's how you pronounce it, as the Xavier figure. Those two figures in Claremont's mind represented the paths of violence versus peace that he wanted to explore. I admit that I don't know that much about Israeli politics, so I can't talk about that allegory in specifics or how effective it is. But I can say that Claremont's idea was to show how a terrorist casts aside violence and becomes a statesman devoted to peace, which we'll get into more later on. As an aside, I'm pretty sure that Claremont also established the friendship between Xavier and Magneto in one of the flashback stories that he wrote that was set in Israel.
You know, I have heard non-Jews, mostly Christians, mind you, talk about going to Israel, changing them and being formative. And I can just imagine how a trip to Israel would affect Claremont as a Jew. And honestly, I love it when profound experiences affect a writer on such a degree. I can imagine going to Ireland or Sweden having an effect on me as well. And there isn't any religious connection there for me with either of those places. That would really intensify the experience. But if I could use this as a segue into a couple of other X-Men that I liked as a kid. While I was not a person of faith at the time I was reading X-Men in the 80s through 1994, I really liked that Nightcrawler was. I hadn't really seen too many Christians represented in comics. There was Daredevil, but I didn't read much of Daredevil as a kid, and I admit I'm kind of ashamed of that. But it was really just Nightcrawler for me that held that Christian role. But I also liked that Gambit was Wolverine's only match in the Danger Room. Plus, I thought the Thieves Guild of New Orleans was a great twist on a good guy character, especially that he was a master thief and eventually even became the king of thieves. I hadn't really considered that a thief could be a good guy until that point. As for the others, my interest in them was mostly in how they related to Wolverine. Claremont and Byrne really made Wolverine awesome. In fact, for a time, he was my favorite character. I loved that he was always on the verge of going savage. And being a big Freddy Krueger fan, you know I love the claws. I like Cyclops, too, but I loved his relationship with Logan and the complicated relationship they both had with Jean Grey. For Jean, it was really the classic example of the rich kid Boy Scout of Scott Summers versus the poor kid bad boy of Logan. The good guy Scott was a great leader and a good person, at least as long as Jean was around, and Logan was a wanderer with very little money that played by his own rules. However, both Scott and Logan were badasses, so maybe that played a factor in there too. But either way, the relationship between the three of them with the volatile person of Jean Grey in the midst made for some great drama and hilarious moments.
That's fair. I mean, Gambit is an interesting choice because he came in towards the end of Claremont's run, and we'll probably never see what he would have happened with him had Claremont stayed on the book. But I will say that Gambit made a really cool first impression, and he gets some really good moments while Claremont's around to develop him. His rivalry with Logan, his friendships with Jubilee and Aurora, and the teasing with him and Rogue were all good. The Thieves Guild idea came in later, and that stuff was interesting. I think they squandered Gambit's potential later, unfortunately, by tying Gambit to the Morlock Massacre, and that made him a difficult character to like after that. But Claremont got Gambit back in his 2000s run on Extreme X-Men, and I felt like he worked as this gray character where you didn't know whose side he was on. And I admit that Gambit and Bishop were cool together, too. I mean, you had the thief and the mutant cop forced to work together, and they had this buddy cop rivalry that evolved into an odd couple friendship. Now, as I said, I was a huge fan of Wolvie back when I got into the books, and I agree that the Claremont Byrne stuff was really great. If anybody wants my detailed thoughts on that era, I have a series of articles up on Comic Crusaders that covers all the way to the Paul Smith run. But honestly, my favorite Wolverine stuff starts with Claremont and Frank Miller. Miller originally didn't want to do Wolverine because he wasn't interested in doing a story about a psycho killer. It took Claremont to talk him out of that. And at that time, Claremont really wasn't either. He wanted to do a story about a fallen samurai, an animal who was trying to become a man and live up to these ancient Japanese values. So you get this really awesome story in Japan where Wolverine goes and fights ninjas. But at its core, the Claremont Miller story is about a man who is broken and has to rebuild himself to earn the love of Mariko Yoshida. If I'm honest, I prefer Logan's romance with Mariko to the one he had with Jean. I feel like it's deeper and more meaningful, and it hits the core of who Logan is as a character. And to this day, I still hate that they killed Mariko off. As for other characters I really love, I agree completely about Nightcrawler. Kurt is such a fun character with a ton of depth. There's a classic X-Men backup story where Logan challenges Kurt to walk through the town of Salem Center without hiding his face behind an image inducer. And then there's the old Excalibur stories with Kurt doing Edgar Rice Burroughs style swashbuckling adventures, and those are great too. I'm also a huge fan of Kitty Pryde. I mean, she was the character I grew up with, and I saw the X-Men through, and I love how much she's grown and matured over the years. Also, Rogue and Psylocke are really awesome, too. I mean, Rogue had this really well-done redemption arc that influenced pretty much how I do it. And Psylocke starts off as this cool, composed, and mysterious British lady who eventually becomes this ninja adrenaline junkie. Honorable mention to Storm, who gets probably the most fascinating character arc that I have ever seen under Claremont, even if nobody else outside of X-Men the Animated Series can write Aurora to save their lives.
I really wish I had read the other X-Men titles. I can see now that I really missed a lot. I don't recall reading any stories with Psylocke in them, although I clearly remember her being around at the time. And honestly, X-Men the Animated Series got a lot of stuff right. But if I could take us back to Claremont's run, I want to talk about a couple of the first real big stories that came out during his time. The first really big and popular stories from Claremont's X-Men was the Dark Phoenix saga, as I understand it anyway. The big climax to the story with Jean dying was not how Claremont wrote it originally, however. According to Jim Shooter, Claremont's original ending was Jean got her mind fixed by the Shi'ar and just went back to living with the X-Men and everything was fine. This is a very anticlimactic ending, considering that she murdered an entire planet. Jim Shooter, who was the editor, by the way, suggested that she should at least go to prison or something. But Claremont didn't like that idea because the whole story would be taken over by the X-Men trying to get her out of prison. So Shooter said, well, you're the writer, you figure it out. Apparently, as a bluff, Claremont came swaggering into Shooter's office the next morning and said, we'll just kill her. To which Shooter immediately agreed and said, that works. We'll kill her. Let's do it. Claremont left the office, and a few minutes later, John Byrne called up Jim Shooter and asked him if he was crazy for killing off Jean Grey. But ultimately, that issue where she died had astronomical sales. In fact, Dark Phoenix Saga really put the X-Men on the map, both critically and in sales.
That generally covers the situation pretty well. I cover a lot of this in my article series on Comic Crusaders. In fact, I have one article that focuses entirely on the Dark Phoenix saga. I'd suggest reading that if you want to know my deep dive thoughts. So while I'm not going to rehash all of that here, I will give you the high points. Claremont and Byrne thought that everything was approved and it was in the can, but it turns out that it hadn't been approved by Shooter, who was editor-in-chief. At that time, Shooter was involved in making sure that the stories all worked at Marvel, and I think that it helped that in keeping the story quality as good as it was when he was AIC. While Shooter would later make decisions that I didn't like nearly as much, resurrecting Green Gray, I think that he did the right thing in this case. Jean sacrificing herself to save the universe was absolutely the right way to end the Dark Phoenix saga, and it's an example of how the back and forth creative process can make a story better. Because Shooter was right when he said that the original ending did not work. And Shooter's influence here provided the impetus for Claremont and Byrne to do something much better that they would not have otherwise done.
You know the old saying, iron sharpens iron? Well, they sharpen each other because of friction. It is the friction that pulls away the unwanted bits and sharpens the blade of the sword. Well, from what I can tell, Shooter and Claremont had their share of huge verbal fights as they argued back and forth. But as you said, Steve, it was this back and forth process that sharpened the blade that was the X-Men title. The next really big story was Days of Future Past. It is, from what I can tell, a story where Xavier has to look at a world in this very World War II Nazi Germany type of future where half of the X-Men are dead and all the ones that are still alive are essentially living on borrowed time and all the things that Magneto said would happen based on his own experience as a boy in Auschwitz happened. All of the horrors he foretold, knowing what prejudice and hate and fear can make people turn into, became a reality in that future, and it was a nightmare. But as far as Charles go, it seems to me that perhaps Charles acknowledged that what Magneto had said was a possibility up until that point in that nightmare future. But before, I believe, his hope and optimism ruled out. In our What Makes a Good Villain episode, we discussed my Cartesian three-act structure. Well, I think this is a big old act two for Xavier and an eye-opener to readers too, I imagine. But what do you think, Steve? Am I way off here?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that sounds like a reasonable take to me. Interestingly enough, Days of Future Past teases what Claremont's direction for Magneto was, but we'll get into that in a bit. Unfortunately, it turned out that Magneto was right in that timeline, with Sentinels taking over the country and turning the world into a nightmare. And this is one of the rare cases where X-Men from an alternate timeline are totally brutalized and killed, and we truly feel for the lives that are lost. It's not a case of, okay, we know they're fine in the real timeline, so there are no stakes, we don't care. What makes this different, I think, is the lingering threat that this world could still happen. And there's a hanging fear that Wolverine may still get his flesh bastard off his skeleton by a Sentinels in a few decades' time. They also get these deeply emotional deaths where we feel the loss as it happens. At the same time, even though these awful things happen, it's not meant to be all doom and gloom. The inciting incident for the timeline, the assassination of Senator Kelly, is stopped by Kitty's older self with the help of the present-day X-Men. So there's a hope that a better world can be made out of this if the X-Men learn from what happened in the other timeline and find a better path. This is what I think Xavier takes away from it, and that provides a light at the end of the tunnel. I'll also add that Days of Future Past introduces a great character who all too often goes unnoticed, and that is Rachel Summers. Rachel is presented as a telepath that helps the future X-Men, but she comes back later. Eventually, she travels in time physically, and she joins the X-Men and becomes a founding member of Excalibur. We find out later that Rachel was Scott and Jean's daughter from that timeline. In that world, the Dark Phoenix saga didn't end in Jean's death. So Rachel comes back to a past where things don't happen as she remembers them, but she's haunted by the Holocaust that she remembers from her future. At one point, she becomes the new Phoenix avatar, and Rachel gets awesome after that. Unfortunately, she's a character that a lot of writers tend not to handle well, aside from Claremont. So Rachel doesn't get the credit she deserves. Also, her interactions with Magneto under Claremont are great. But speaking of Magneto, why don't we get into what happens to him?
Sure thing, Steve. I think that Days of Future Past also set the stage for redeeming Magneto, which would come after Days of Future Past, as we could start to see him as a sort of, you know, like a tragic figure. I really like the idea of redeeming Magneto, actually. I appreciated that while I could disagree with his methods, I could not say that he didn't have a point. Well, minus the whole homo superior concept anyway. I heard Claremont compare him to Macbeth, who started out as a noble hero, a trusted knight, but he suddenly finds himself on a path that makes sense to him. But you're watching the degradation, the corruption, the destruction of someone who could have been a noble hero. This is what I mean about the tragic hero in Magneto. He could have easily been a good guy if life did not put him on the path that he was on. There was nothing innately evil about him. In fact, from a certain perspective, his cause is a righteous one. He tried it Charles' way, and it didn't work. In fact, things got worse, and he could see where they were headed. So he decided, I'm going to do things my own way now. I'm going to take charge and make some real change. So he forms his brotherhood and does what he does. But then Magneto sees that he might have become the very monster he was fighting against when he almost kills Kitty Pryde, a young Jewish mutant. Basically, the very type of person Magneto had been fighting for. Granted, he had been attacked by X-Men in the past, and Kitty was in the uniform and attacking him, but he had no idea she was just a child. This was compounded by the fact that his own daughter had been burned alive around Kitty's age for being different, and that moment became world-shattering for him.
Right. Now, there was a time when Magneto didn't have a problem with hurting kids, but that was back in the Silver Age. Claremont begins Magneto's transformation by having Magneto be regressed to infancy and then re-aged back to a 30-year-old. Don't ask. The idea is that the Silver Age Magneto had been destroyed during that event, with Claremont's Magneto emerging as a rebirth. It's a bit convoluted, but it's decent enough handwave for all the old Silver Age stuff that doesn't conflict with this. But I think that the decision to play up Magneto's Jewish past and the Holocaust both gives him his driving reasons, as well as sets up the path of redemption later. I think the Macbeth comparison kind of works, although that was a different kind of corruptive arc. Macbeth is tempted by ambition and the influence of his wife. Magneto is haunted by the torment he suffers in his past, the murder of his family at the hands of the Nazis, and then the death of his daughter, Anya. He's unable to see a better path for his people after all that horror, so he takes the darker path so that nobody else suffers as he did. There's still nobility in Magneto, even after all that he's done, and that's what plants the seed for his redemption later. Magneto becomes blinded by his own self-righteousness, and he fails to see who he's hurting along the way. In the same story where he almost kills Kitty, Magneto does some pretty awful things that come back to haunt him later. The Russians send a nuclear sub to attack Magneto, and then Magneto retaliates by destroying the sub and killing all hands on board. He then takes it a step further by destroying the Russian town of Varikino in retaliation. It isn't until he realizes that he almost killed Kitty, someone who in many ways was like his daughter Anya, that Magneto understands the damage that he's caused and the true price of his dream. I really like Magneto's redemption arc and where it takes him after that. Magneto tries to redemption by turning himself in and standing trial before the world court for his actions. That leads to the trial of Magneto in X-Men 200, which is a pretty good story that ends up with the X-Men facing down Fenris, the twin mutant children of the Nazi Baron Wolfgang von Strucker. Xavier gets severely hurt at the end of the battle, and he ends up going to the Shi'ar galaxy with Lilandra, leaving Magneto to take over the school in his absence. And that, for me, is when it gets awesome. I'll be honest, my favorite period with Magneto was when he was headmaster of the New Mutants. Claremont didn't really want Xavier to be the permanent teacher because he didn't see what Xavier could learn from the kids. But a man like Magneto, who was trying to change, could learn from the idealism of the kids in his care. And he could teach them how to survive in ways that Xavier would never think to, because Magneto has survived in situations that even Xavier could never imagine. The kids didn't trust Magneto at first, but Magneto gradually earns their trust and they grow to respect him. Even has some really strong relationships with what some of the New Mutants, especially characters like Magic, who can relate to Magneto's darker outlook. The New Mutants were at their best when Magneto was in charge of the team because they all grew together despite having very different ways of looking at the world. Anyway, Magneto's path of reform doesn't last, and that's because of editorial interference and the growing influence of the image artists at Marvel. Claremont wanted to tell a story, and in the early 90s, the X office wanted to go more back to basics. So Claremont would try to find compromises that work with his vision of Magneto, and then he left in the early 90s. So the Magneto we've mostly seen since then is a version that is more blood-soaked, but is traumatized by his past as a Holocaust survivor. I'd say that Claremont's lasting contribution to Magneto is the fact that Magneto is driven by the horrors he's endured at the hands of the Nazis, and that he wants to avoid the repeat of that suffering for mutant kind. That makes him a character that could work either in a heroic role, a villainous role, or a morally ambiguous role that casts him as a great character. And honestly, I think that really works best for Magneto, as much as I'd have loved to see Claremont's original idea brought to its proper conclusion.
You know, if sales are any indication, Magneto going bad again seems to be exactly what people wanted. Because X-Men number one, where he does that, is to my knowledge still holding the record in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most sales of a single issue, with 8,186,500 copies sold. But before you let that number astonish you, and yes, I use that word on purpose too, consider that there were five variant covers of the issue that formed a larger picture when you put them together. So if you divide those 8,186,500 copies by five for each of the variant covers, then the sales drop to 1,637,300 sales, which is still very good, but not quite as impressive. I also don't think that it's a coincidence that that number divides exactly by five. In fact, the whole variant cover thing really took off after that.
Yeah, this is really a case where business interests start to override story interests. And as painful as it is to admit, it's with some justification in this case. So let's talk about what the X-Men became after Claremont left the books. I'm just going to hit the highlights here because otherwise this is a three-episode pod. There's just too much stuff out there. The 90s run definitely tried to keep the flavor of the Claremont-Jim Lee run, but it flailed in some ways like the books had lost their voice. At least it felt that way to me. I mean, it's hard to adjust someone else with these characters after 17 person writing all the stories. There were some stories here and there. I mean, even though there were more frequent event stories year after year, but I will say in fairness that there were good single issue stories here and there. I dug the story where Cannonball fought Gladiator that one time and somehow won. There's a nice story about Jubilee having a real moment with Professor X around the time when Eliana supposedly died. Don't worry, she got better. There's a cool story where Iceman has a confrontation with Emma Frost, and this leads Bobby to think about his potential and how to use his powers in new ways.
You know, I have a quick question there while we're talking about Iceman. In the original X-Men, he was basically a snowman. Then later he turned into a solid ice form. But then he found out that he is actually ridiculously powerful, an Omega-level mutant, in the words of writer Mike Carey. My understanding is that he can affect the ecosystem of the entire world like some kind of god of winter. My question is this. Did they explain that journey in the comics? And was Bobby's confrontation with Emma Frost part of the Omega-level realization?
I would say basically yes. I seem to recall that Bobby grew gradually more powerful over the years with a lot of different writers contributing to it. I think the power creep started with early X-Factor when he got a power-enhancing belt for a while and then stopped needing to wearing it later. I think there were enhancements because of the Inferno event too, but I don't remember too well now. And then Bobby started training with Emma, and she started teaching him new power tricks that he hadn't previously thought of. Emma's training is where I think Bobby really starts to take off, and then other writers ran with that. But honestly, I think it's likely that Iceman always had the potential to be ludicrously powerful. It's just that Bobby kept putting limits on himself subconsciously. Over time, he just keeps pushing his way past his mental blocks and gets better with his powers.
As a quick note there, would you compare that to, say, Wally with the Flash?
Yeah, that's totally fair. Yeah, that's probably fair. Yeah, I would say so. Okay. Yeah, normal guy who, you know, gradually gets more powerful and, you know, just due to, you know, gradual training with it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But moving on, the one story people remember around this time, though, is the Age of Apocalypse event. The idea is that Xavier's son Legion returns and he decides to go back in time and put an end to Magneto so that Xavier's dream can be realized. This plan ends up going badly, and through a series of events, Xavier is killed instead. This creates a timeline where Magneto becomes the leader of the X-Men, inspired by the memory of Charles, and Apocalypse succeeds in taking over the world. However, Bishop, as a time traveler, remembers the world that was, and he knows that this timeline was never supposed to exist. So the various X-Men teams go on different missions designed to set things to right, and you get huge confrontation with Apocalypse at the end, ending with a nuclear holocaust that destroys everything. It's really awesome.
Wow. That sounds so epic.
Oh, it totally was. And Age of Apocalypse is probably my favorite X-Men story out of this whole period. This event worked because you got some really creative interpretations of the AOA X-Men. You get Rogue leading a team with characters like Morph, Blink, Sabretooth, Wildchild, and Sunfire, all of whom are really great in this book. You get a Wolverine who's missing a hand but ends up with Jean Grey for a while, and the two go on their own adventures. You get a darker version of Nightcrawler who goes to the Savage Land in search of the lost mutants who made their home there. Kitty and Colossus lead the Generation X team, or Generation Next as they were called, and we see what Chamber would have been like if he kept his face intact. And you get some creepy villains like the Sugar Man and Holocaust. Everything felt like a coherent story, and you really got to like these reinvented characters in the time that we spend with them. There's a reason why Age of Apocalypse is generally considered one of the top X-Men stories, even compared with some of the Claremont stories.
Now, I seem to remember Marvel saying that Namor was the first mutant, but as I recall, Apocalypse was said to be the very first mutant. Did they sort that out, or am I remembering it wrong? Also, I can't help but notice that time travel would come up again with Apocalypse in regards to Cable.
No, there's a reason for that. Namor is called the first mutant because he appeared first chronologically in terms of publication. I think the Submariner first appeared in 1939. Apocalypse is generally considered the first mutant in-universe, though he didn't appear until X-Factor came out in the late 80s. That having been said, I don't think even Pocky is technically the first mutant. Selene, the Black Queen of the Hellfire Club, has been alive since the Hyborian Age. As in, she's old enough to have met Conan the Barbarian, and she knows ancient wizards like Kulan Gath. So I think she's probably the oldest I can.
Wow, I had no idea that they were mutants that old. I mean, Hyborian Age makes Apocalypse seem like a young pup.
The mutant immortals like the Externals get really interesting. I'll also add that some of the books were really good in the 90s. X-Factor under Peter David was awesome, taking a number of cast-off characters from X-Men like Havoc, Polaris, Multiple Man, Strong Guy, Wolfsbane, and Quicksilver, and turning them into a government mutant squad. There's so many good issues there, but But my favorite is the issue where they all go to therapy with Doc Samson. That one issue made Quicksilver a sympathetic character, and there are some hilarious lines in it, too. I'm also a fan of Excalibur whenever Alan Davis drew that book.
See, I didn't even know there was a whole group of immortal mutants called the Externals. That's pretty cool, actually. X-Factor is one of those books I definitely regret having not read, especially after this conversation. But I believe you wanted to talk about a particular run on the X-Men title, didn't you, Steve?
All right. It's hard to discuss X-Men without talking about one of their more controversial eras, which is the Grant Morrison run. Now, I'm a huge fan of Grant Morrison, especially when he's writing DC characters. At the same time, I felt like he was a mixed bag on the X-Men, unfortunately. Morrison brought in some ideas that revitalized the franchise, and he'll put a lot of thought into the world building that he did. Totally give him credit for that. At the same time, I never felt like Morrison showed a good grasp of the main characters. You'd have characters do strange things just because they were cool or edgy, not because they necessarily made sense. I didn't like his take on Magneto at all, though the Zorn character that he created was neat. And don't even get me started on the Cyclops-Emma Frost relationship. I mean, seriously, I know there are people who love the two of them together, and I don't deny that they have chemistry. But Scott particularly is written out of character in this run, and it's never sufficiently explained. It tends to be rationalized as the after effect of Apocalypse briefly possessing him, but this is mostly people doing the work of the comic. Morrison only addresses Scott's issues briefly, explaining as Scott coming to some realization about a self-delusion he previously had, but what that self-delusion was, what he realized, or how that changed him is never explained. It also doesn't make sense that Scott wouldn't turn to Jean first if Apocalypse's influence really is the problem. I mean, it's not as though Phoenix wouldn't understand being possessed by a powerful entity and being forced to do terrible things under its influence. And really, mind control and possession are such a common thing in X-Men comics that it's ridiculous. And in most cases, they go on like nothing happened. But it's Scott, one of the most self-controlled members of the entire team, who's had tons of mental training by Xavier and Jean, who gets messed up so hard he starts like acting like a different person. Really? It just never made much sense to me. Morrison is a great writer, and he's written many of my favorite stories of all time, but the character portrayals in New X-Men never rang true to me.
I can see how that would be an issue. Scott is such a core character to the mythos, and he had a really well-established character, too. To change that to what sounds like an extreme degree would not sit well with me either. I haven't read it personally, but it would seem to me that the Phoenix Saga would have prepared Scott for what he went through there, not just because he understood the concept of being possessed or controlled because of what Jean went through, but in my head, Scott's struggle with the loss of Jean seems like it would have made him stronger and more durable to me. I'm not saying I don't get acknowledging that it would suck, but I think Scott could take that, especially if mind control or whatever was such a common occurrence.
Oh, agreed on that. But now I want to focus on the elements I liked about that run. The lineup was pretty reasonable. I mean, focusing on Jean, Cyclops, Emma Frost, Beast, and Wolverine. I think Morrison came out with a neat idea with secondary mutations. I like how he thought through the societal aspects, like the idea of an open mutant who is also a famous fashion designer. The villains were new, and with the exception of Cassandra Nova, I like the majority of them. Right at Xavier's was a really fun story. The idea of Weapon X as Weapon 10 was an interesting take, and it opened up avenues for developing the history of super soldiers in the Marvel Universe. Mutant Town was a neat setting that was explored well in other titles, including Peter David's second X-Factor run. And then you got some interesting new characters out of it, including Phantom X and Dust. New X-Men is very much a love it or hate it run, it must be said. I hated it for a long time, but I eventually came around on some elements of it. But I don't deny that by the time Morrison came in, the book needed his brand of creativity to get people interested, even if I take issue with the way that we went about it at times. And Morrison's run set up some really great stuff, like the John Wayne and John Cassaday run, which I'll get to in a little bit. But there's no question, that it was a franchise. Around that time, Claremont would come back a couple of times, starting the early 2000s. But none of those repeat appearances ever had the same level of impact that his original run did, unfortunately. Still, I think his run on Extreme X-Men in the 2000s was pretty solid and came the closest to recapturing the old magic. Anytime Claremont teamed up with Spanish artist Salvador La Roca, you get some pretty good X-Men comics. Claremont and LaRocca were together on the first half of the series, and it was a globetrotting adventure with fun stories. The second half wasn't quite as good. Igor Cordy came in, and I didn't think he fit the visual styles of the series too well, but he got some pretty decent stuff there until the end of the run. There was also a Kitty Pryde miniseries called Mechanics. Don't ask me why it's called that. By Claremont that I also really liked around that time as well. He periodically come back over the years after this too, but sadly it always seemed to be with diminishing returns each time. And it's sad for me to say because I don't think anyone has done or ever will do the X-Men as well as Claremont did it.
I have to wonder if part of Claremont's issue in the times he returned to the mutant titles was trying to make something out of what became someone else's sandbox. That would be difficult. Also, I'm fairly certain, based on how often I've changed as I've grown and matured as an adult, that Claremont was just not the same guy who wrote those comics anymore.
Apparently. It happens even to the best, sadly, though. I'm glad to see that he's able to come back from time to time, even if he's not the writer he was back in the day. But one of my personal favorite runs on X-Men was the Joss Whedon run. Now, Whedon is a name that currently is mired in a lot of controversy because of his personal behavior, and I don't want to shy away from that completely. But at the time, he came onto the X-Men with a lot of fanfare. And just talking about the quality of the book, you got some really great comics. I mean, you can tell that Whedon was steeped in the old Claremont stuff and understood the formula, but he also embraced a lot of the cool new ideas that Morrison added. Under Whedon, the X-Men went back to being proper superheroes again and trying to repair the PR situation, which I felt made sense at the time. The book felt like a part of the Marvel Universe when it needed to, and you got occasional involvement with S.H.I.E.L.D., with the FF, and the Avengers, without it being constant crossovers. And honestly, by adding Kitty Pryde and Colossus, you got a really good team. Emma stuck around as the main telepath, and the rest of the Morrison team clicked well. And Kitty became the gateway into the team as the book's narrator. And I felt like Whedon really got Kitty down well. Whedon also introduced some interesting new mutants like Blindfold and Armor. Armor ended up being Wolvie's new sidekick and a member of the team by the end of it. The book was also legitimately funny at times. Whedon's style of snarky humor has kind of overstayed his welcome today. Mainly because of people who followed that style and did it badly. But I still love Emma and Kitty snarking at each other constantly, especially because Kitty has every reason in the world to hate Emma. Kitty getting into Kitty's face with, "You teach ethics?" is still a hilarious moment. Logan sneaking into Scott and Emma's bedroom, after they did the deed and sarcastically asking, "What stage of grieving is this?" The dialogue was fresh and clever. Lockheed actually gets some good moments, too, as he burns the main villain in the face. And even after that, a journalist asks Kitty, "What is your relationship with the bat?" referring to Lockheed. This is a good example of how to do this style of humor right without turning the whole book into slapstick.
Those sound like some really great moments. I mean, Emma Frost teaching ethics is pretty friggin' hilarious considering her past. And I have to say that moment with Logan sneaking into the room sounds like something Logan would do if he was drunk. Was he drunk?
You know, I don't remember for sure, but I wouldn't be at all shocked if he was. That's definitely something Logan would do after a few beers. We do see Wolverine's love for beer come up repeatedly around this time. Are you a beer? So I wouldn't rule it out. That's not to say, though, that this run was perfect, as it did stumble a bit. The second arc making the Danger Room sentient, I mean, something that was tried before but was ignored, and there were a couple of plot holes in it. The X-Men lure Danger to Genosha, and the hand wave for why Magneto doesn't just show up and destroy the killer robot in 10 seconds is pretty nonsensical. To be fair, you do get a really cool scene where Colossus throws Kitty in a fastball special, so it's not all bad. But that story wasn't great. Now, the following story focusing on Emma and the Hellfire Club called Torn is awesome. All in all, I still really enjoy this run purely on its creative merits. But you do kind of have to separate the art from the artist now, sadly.
You know, separating those things has never been an issue for me. When something is good, it's good, regardless of the source. When something is wise, it's still wise, even if the person who said it is evil. I mean, even a broken clock is right twice a day. But that said, Whedon's sense of humor, as you mentioned, was more funny back in the day, but has since grown tired for me. In the same fashion that slapstick was funny when I was a kid, but just isn't anymore. And in that opinion, you'll note it has nothing to do with his behavior and is all about the art he produces.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to look at it. But to move to more pleasant topics, one X-Men run that I don't think gets enough credit is the Mike Carey run. Mike Carey is one of those great British writers who is beloved by Vertigo fans because of his runs on Lucifer and Hellblazer, and for good reason. And he does a lot of really good independent stuff, too. But Carey can also write really good mainstream superhero stuff. And his most notable Marvel run was his X-Men. He jumped around a bit on the X-Men titles. He did a run on the Adjectiveless X-Men book, and then it changed into X-Men Legacy, which was an Xavier-centric book. I think it's one of the more solid post-Claremont runs, honestly. The team he started with was pretty cool, as I recall. The team included the likes of Rogue, Cannonball, Cable, Mystique, Sabretooth, Iceman, Mastermind, and an obscure character called the Omega Sentinel. This is a team that had a lot of weird characters and loose cannons, so much so that it shouldn't have worked, but somehow it does. The setup doesn't last, especially when the book shifts to X-Men Legacy, but it's a really fun book during this phase. Later on, there's also a really neat event story Carey did called Age of X, focusing on an alternate timeline where humankind is hunted to the brink of extinction. I don't want to spoil this one because it's got some interesting twists, but it's not that long, and it's enjoyable, and it's a self-contained read. Carey's run doesn't get talked up nearly enough, but it lasted about 5 years, and there's a lot of really great material there. But I drifted in and out of X-Men for years after that, but there's one other major run that I liked. There was the Schism event where Cyclops and Wolverine briefly went their separate ways. Scott was building a movement on an island, Utopia, in San Francisco, while Logan went back to the X-Mansion and reopened the school. The idea of Logan as a headmaster was really interesting, and the book was called Wolverine and the X-Men, which was written by Jason Aaron. Wolverine and the X-Men was a really, really weird book, but it was a fun kind of weird. You had characters like a heroic brood teenager named Brew, a Krakoa being based on the Living Island, we'll talk about that, and Quentin Quire, who is a rogue telepath who started a riot back in Morrison's run. You had teleporting elves running around. I mean, alien monarchs putting their superpowered kids in school, and Wolverine going out on a gambling trip with Quentin Quire. This is the kind of book that embraced insanity and the kind of madcap fun they only find in superhero comics.
We're going to talk about Wolverine and the X-Men animated series in part two of this discussion, so I don't want to dig too deep into it right now, but I am curious if the comic and the series had more than the name in common. Was it anything like the book?
Not beyond the headline character. The comic probably was given that title to bring in fans of the cartoon, but aside from that, there really wasn't much in common. I'm here briefly about the Brian Michael Bendis run, which he did after he finished his time on Avengers. I like the basic setup of it, but it wore out its welcome and dragged on way too long. The basic idea was that Beast convinced that spiritual X-Men have lost their way. So he goes back in time and brings their younger teenage selves to the present to stage an intervention. In fairness to Bendis, I don't think this was a bad idea. And you get some decent issues dealing with this early on. But then these teenage X-Men stayed way too long. This should have been a story with a limited time span because the younger X-Men have to forget what happened and go back to when they came from. But instead, they stick around 4 years, go through major changes, and so on. Teen Jean got a solo book, and Kid Cyclops even joined the Champions for a while. Even after Bendis left the X-Men books, the younger X-Men continued to stick around for ages. Eventually, they did all go back, but you still see references to it sometimes. This time Champions, for example. I think there's still some of that came out of the idea, but this is an example of the kind of idea that got dragged out way too long. Things.
Is it just me, or is Marvel's MO to run things into the ground? I've heard several accounts from you about them doing exactly that, and it sounds like the Bendis run was definitely one of those times.
No, it's definitely not just you. I think Marvel likes to ride the wave for as long as it's profitable, then ditch it as soon as it's run its course. The Clone Saga may be the most infamous example, but there are others. And the last run I'll mention may be another example of this. So I'll want to talk briefly about the current era with the X-Men on Krakoa. So Jonathan Hickman was brought in, presumably with the idea of revitalizing the franchise the way that Morrison did in the early 2000s. And for a little while, it succeeded. People were talking about this run and the ideas it introduced constantly. Hickman started with two miniseries that ran concurrently called Powers of X and House of X. Although Hickman's a writer I have problems connecting to on an emotional level, I admit I was intrigued by this idea back when it started. The basic setup was interesting, and it introduces some really neat ideas. What basically happened is that Moira MacTaggert changes the timeline. It turns out that she has a Groundhog's Day mutant power to relive her life from her beginning every time she dies. So in this new timeline, she convinces Xavier to try something different. So Xavier reaches out to Magneto, and they decide to create a mutant nation state on the island of Krakoa. Yes, the same Krakoa, the living island from Giant Size X-Men number one. So they build an entire mutant society on this island, using their powers to find solutions to various problems. They even manage to get around the problem of death by being able to clone bodies, back up the minds of the Krakoan people with brain tapes, and then implant their memories in the clones. But at the same time, there's a Sentinel program being developed and other problems that they have to deal with. I think the setup is interesting as a short-term thing. I never got the feeling that the Krakoa nation was going to last the way things were going. Hickman built in some very clear cracks in the system between all the villains on the ruling council, the refusal to resurrect precogs like Destiny, making an instant enemy of Mystique, and Moira is the weak link holding this timeline together. Let's face it, a country with people like Apocalypse, Sinister, and the Hellfire Club as its decision makers is not going to survive. Well, played out as a gradual rise and fall story, though. I think Marvel could have had something going with this, something great with this. But then the new status quo got popular, and the Krakoa run kept getting played out more and more. And while I liked House of X and Powers of X, I just lost interest in where the books were going after that, and I just tuned out of the whole thing. And then Hickman left before he finished his story. Before he finished his story as well. I think there was something really promising with these ideas, but it's since evolved into something I don't recognize, and I've just lost interest in it. Sometimes the series becomes a victim of its own success, and it happens. But hey, it's comics. What goes around usually comes around again in a few years, so we'll see where things go next. So we'll get into the video games next, and I know we have some that we love to talk about. But before we do, Mike, I have a question. There have been tons of X-Men lineups over the years, more than I could even begin to list here. But everybody has their favorite team of X-Men. So what are your favorite X-Men lineups you've seen and why? Also, did you follow any of the spin-off mutant groups like X-Factor? And if so, are there any teams that you've enjoyed?
For me, I guess Professor X, Cyclops, who was Field Commander, Jean Grey, Wolverine, Gambit, Storm, Beast, Jubilee, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Rogue, and I want to say Iceman was there too. Not sure where they fell into the history or if I'm just amalgamating teams in my mind. It has been 30 years since I read the X-Men. But those are folks I remember being in the comics I read. I suppose I like the relationship dynamics of the team, particularly as it pertained to Wolverine, Scott, and Jean. I also like the big brother relationship Wolverine had with Jubilee. As to the other titles, I did not read many of those at all. I mostly read X-Men and Wolverine.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly when that would have been either. Maybe the late 90s. It is more or less the animated series team with a couple of others, and that's a pretty solid lineup. The team I started with is the Claremont Romita team, which was made up of Storm, Wolverine, Nightcrawler, Kitty Pryde, Rogue, and Rachel Summers. So I have a soft spot for that group. The X-Men Blue team from the Jim Lee era was cool. That group had Cyclops, Beast, Wolvie, Psylocke, Rogue, Gambit, and Jubilee. And I dig the Whedon and Cassidy lineup quite a bit. But my favorite mutant team are the classic New Mutants. That team featured Danny Moonstar, Cannonball, Sunspot, Wolfsbane, Magic, Magma, Cypher, Warlock, and Karma. It was a really diverse group in just about every way you'd want, from backgrounds to powers to personalities. And they were well-equipped to do just about anything. But I could talk about them a little more when we get into the film next time. Anyway, why don't we talk about how the X-Men have done in video games?
All right. There have actually been a total of 24 X-Men video games, and I'll be honest, I've only played two of them. But these games stretch way back to 1989 with the Uncanny X-Men for the NES, all the way up to 2014 with X-Men Days of Future Past. I have played X-Men Legends from 2004 and X-Men Legends 2 Rise of Apocalypse from 2005 on the PS2, and I will talk about those in a bit. Characters from the X-Men have even appeared in 14 other video games, of which, again, I've only played two of. The Marvel Ultimate Alliance game from 2006 and Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 from 2009, both on PS2. As far as playstyle and format goes, both of those games are a lot like the X-Men Legend games. Anyway, those 38 games do not even count the five Wolverine video games stretching from 1991 to 2009 and the upcoming Wolverine game for the PlayStation 5. Honestly, when it comes to video games, I'm a casual gamer, but my boy Steve here is pretty into it and has been for a really long time. So I'll turn this particular part of the discussion over to you, Steve.
The X-Men have been around in video games for a very long time. You're right that they go all the way back to 1989 in the NES game. Now, I have not played every, and some games I only have like a casual familiarity with, but the X-Men have a long history in gaming. I'm not going to mention every single thing, but I do want to cover some of the highlights. The NES game was followed by Madness and Murder World on PC, where you play as a group of X-Men going through Murder World and fighting Arcade. The main villains are Magneto and Arcade, and you fight the members of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants along the way. I played that game a little, and it was an okay game for the time, if a little frustrating. That was followed by a sequel on PC called X-Men 2: The Fall of the Mutants. It was more or less an adaptation of the Fall of the Mutants crossover event from the comics, which featured the X-Men, X-Factors, and members of Excalibur. You basically choose a team of the five characters, and they go through space and time to fight various enemies, including Mystique and her Brotherhood, which was then called Freedom Force. If you get past them, you get to face the final boss, the Adversary, who was the main villain in the Fall of the Mutants comic as well. I have fond memories of this game, and I appreciated that they adapted the game as well as they did. Although I will add that if you can play Rachel Summers as Phoenix in this game, and she is ridiculously broken. Playing as Rachel makes the adversary fight ludicrously easy. It makes godlike power levels, but that character is a game breaker. I also don't think any discussion of X-Men games could possibly be complete without mentioning the Arcade game. No relation to Arcade the villain. This was a side-scroller game by Konami, and it sucked up a ton of quarters back in the day. You could play as one of six X-Men, Cyclops, Wolverine, Colossus, Storm, Nightcrawler, and Dazzler. Why Dazzler, I don't know. As you'd expect, Magneto is the main villain, and you get to fight members of the Brotherhood as well as Juggernaut, Emma Frost, and Mystique. I remember this game being pretty fun, even if I died in it constantly.
I have not played any of those. Actually, the very first X-Men game I ever played was X-Men Legends, and I have to say that I loved it. I loved being able to play Beast, Colossus, Cyclops, who was a badass, Emma Frost, Gambit, Iceman, Jean Grey, Jubilee, and Magma, who was the focus of the story. Also Nightcrawler, Psylocke, Rogue, and Wolverine, who was also very badass. There's even one mission where you can play as Professor X. I really liked how the gameplay worked, the angle of the cameras and the fighting. In fact, part of the reason I bought the other three games I can talk about was because I loved X-Men Legends so much. Plus, it was a decent storyline. I particularly liked being able to grow and learn with the main character Magma, and I liked the Danger Room challenges. But let's talk about the story for a second. A general synopsis would go like this. Allison Cressmere, Magma, a mutant on the verge of discovering her powers, is a abducted by Blob and Mystique. Wolverine witnessed this abduction and goes on to find them. He soon teams up with Cyclops in order to rescue Allison. After battling Mystique and Blob and saving Allison, all three characters safely escape in the X-Jet. Allison is brought to the Xavier Institute of Gifted Youngsters, where she finds out more about the X-Men and the students, all while exploring her newly discovered powers with the help of Professor Charles Xavier. The X-Men continue to explore leads that might indicate why Mystique and the Brotherhood of Mutants are even interested in Allison. At the same time, they attempt to combat the Brotherhood who saved their leader Magneto from his prison and the growing number of Sentinels. The drama culminates in a number of showdowns on Asteroid M with both Magneto and Master Bolt.
That sounds cool. I discovered X-Men Legends much later than you did when I found a used copy for PS2. I found that it wasn't bad, although it was a bit clunky in terms of the gameplay. But that's forgivable given how old that game is. The core mechanics of the system do work, though, and we see it refined more in Legends 2, as well as in the Ultimate Alliance games. I still haven't finished it, but I like what I played well enough. Now, remember the Allison Crestmere version of MAGA? This game makes me cringe, though. So let me explain where this came from and why I hate it. Okay, this comes from the comics. Basically, Fabian Nicieza didn't like the idea of Magma being from a lost Roman city. So in a New Warrior story, he retconned it so that Magma was a brainwashed British girl. Magma was originally supposed to be Amara Aquila, the daughter of a Roman patrician from Nova Roma, and all that was lost for years. Now, I respect Fabian Nicieza as a writer for many things he's written over the years, including Cable and Deadpool, New Warriors, and Thunderbolts. I don't want to take anything away from him here, but as a fan of the classic New Mutants, I absolutely loathe the Allison Crestmere retcon because it ruined the character. It was reversed later by Claremont in his Extreme X-Men run, thankfully, but Magma was a mess for years because of the story. Still, I won't necessarily hold it against the game to reference the Allison version of the character. It is true to the comics. It's just true to comics I dislike. I'm just very particular when it comes to how the classic New Mutants are portrayed because they're my favorite team.
That makes sense. I suppose if I had read those comics, I might feel the same. But after playing X-Men Legends, I was on the ball when X-Men Legends 2 Rise of Apocalypse came out. That game was a lot of fun, too, and was on a much grander scale than the first game. But honestly, outside of playing the TMNT video game, the X-Men Legends games were the first time I had ever played superhero games, so that added another level of excitement to the whole thing. The story goes something like this. Apocalypse has begun his war on humans and mutants, beginning with his invasion of the mutant-controlled nation of Genosha. Professor X and Magneto come to the realization that the only way to defeat this enemy that threatens all life on the planet is for their respective groups to join forces. The story begins with the X-Men and the Brotherhood launching a rescue mission to save Professor X, who has been captured by Apocalypse. One of the cooler things about X-Men Legends 2 Rise of Apocalypse was that you can mix and match your team with members of the Brotherhood and members of the X-Men. In the following missions, the unlikely group encounter many dangers in Genosha, the Savage Land, Canada's Weapon X facility, a bombed out New York City with sewers crawling with Morlocks, and finally Apocalypse's stronghold in Egypt. Apocalypse is searching for four mutants with harmonic DNA to take over the world. Apparently, Polaris, Quicksilver, Emma Frost, and Sabretooth fit the profile, and one by one, they are taken prisoner by Apocalypse, as are Beast and Angel. Things get worse when Destiny foresees a great treachery by one of the X-Men. In the end, the X-Men and Brotherhood have a massive showdown against Apocalypse and his horsemen. Apocalypse's machine that will help him with his plans eventually malfunctions, and the power of the X-Men and the Brotherhood push Apocalypse in, trapping him in there forever. Apocalypse's four horsemen are released from their hypnotization, and the world is saved once more with the X-Men and Brotherhood back as enemies again. On the top of an Egyptian pyramid, Apocalypse assistant Mr. Sinister is seen laughing maniacally.
I will admit that it seems like Legends 2 did a great job of building on the original. I have not played that much of that one, though, although I did own it on PC for a long time. I just don't think that game works very well on mouse and keyboard, so I gave up after a while of fumbling through it. But I finally got Legends 2 on PS2 at the same time I got the original Legends, and I did dig a little through the opening levels. That game was much less clunky as 1 was, from what I recall, and I like the characters the game gives you, and Apocalypse is a great villain when he's written well, so I can't argue with any of that at all. So it looks to me like they improved on the formula with the sequel while keeping what worked from the original.
I would say so, and I would add that things were definitely turned up to 11 for Legends 2. It's really no wonder that the successor to the Legends came, Marvel Ultimate Alliance, was no small game. I remember feeling that I had really taken a journey as I worked my way through the rather satisfying ending. As with X-Men Legends 2, when I saw that the gameplay was the same for the Ultimate Alliance game, where I could play a tons of people from across the Marvel Universe, I was very excited. But as this discussion is about mutants, I will keep this about mutants for the most part. The basic plot of the game is that Dr. Doom has assembled a new version of the Masters of Evil in his pursuit of becoming a god, which he actually does for a time at the end of the game. After an attack upon SHIELD helicarrier, UNN Alpha, Nick Fury is given the okay to start a task force consisting of Marvel superheroes to combat the Masters of Evil and uncover Dr. Doom's plot. In Marvel Ultimate Alliance, you could play the following mutants: Colossus, Cyclops, Deadpool, Iceman, Jean Grey, Magneto, Nightcrawler, Sabretooth, Storm, and Wolverine. Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 was more fun, in my opinion, as it incorporated elements of Civil War and Secret War. The plot goes like this. After an explosion in Stanford, Connecticut, kills 600 bystanders, sentiment for superheroes reaches an all-time low. The government calls for a Superhero Registration Act, where all superheroes are required to register with the federal government as a human weapon of mass destruction, reveal his or her true identity to the authorities, and undergo proper training. However, not everyone is satisfied with this law. Therefore, players can either side with Iron Man or Mr. Fantastic on the pro-registration side, or Captain America and Luke Cage on the anti-registration side. In Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, you can play the following characters from the mutant titles: Cable, Cyclops, Deadpool, Gambit, Iceman, Jean Grey, Juggernaut, Magneto, Psylocke, Storm, and Wolverine.
Ultimate Alliance is pretty much the X-Men Legends formula brought to the Marvel Universe as a whole. On that level, it works really well. You got a really good selection of X characters, and you got some really solid opposition there, too. I tended to play mostly with Wolverine and Deadpool because of their healing factors, but otherwise I generally played with the Avengers characters. But if you wanted to play through it with all X characters, you could certainly do it, and that's a reasonable lineup of X-Men to play around with if you've unlocked them all. Ultimate Alliance 2 was really good as well, and as I think I've said elsewhere, it was a better version of the Civil War event than the Civil War comics. I think the story was well handled in giving you a choice of which side you wanted to be on, and then making you deal with the consequences of whichever route you selected until the past converges at the end. I don't think you can go wrong with any of those games.
I can agree with that 100%. But we have to switch gears and talk a little bit about X-Men, the animated series, and X-Men Evolution before we wrap up. So why don't you take it from here, Steve, and tell us about 1992's X-Men, the animated series.
Sure, I'd love to. The X-Men, the animated series wasn't the first attempt to bring the X-Men on the small screen. There was an animated film called Pride of the X-Men before that. But the creators made too many compromises with the studio, and the result didn't represent the comics too well. But they learned from that, and I think by the time they developed X-Men, the animated series, they'd gotten it right. And as right as you probably could get with those stories on screen in some cases. The other major factor was that Margaret Loesch took over as head of the Fox Kids division. And that was a time of unprecedented creative freedom over in the Fox animated division. According to the showrunners, Loesch really believed in getting in the X-Men when many people wouldn't, and that really was the key to getting the show made. So Eric Liewald became the showrunner, his wife Julia was a key writer on the show, and you had Larry Houston as their art director. Interestingly enough, the Liewalds didn't know the X-Men out the gate, but Houston knew the comics inside and out, and some of the growth spurts you see in the first season came out of that collaboration. Eventually, the Liewalds got what the X-Men were, and they were able to tap into what made the X-Men so popular. They tapped into the X-Men's universal appeal, the feeling of being an outsider, the socio-political themes, and all the rest. And in later seasons, they did it so well that X-Men the Animated Series, to this day, offers some of the best adaptations of the classic Claremont stories ever put to screen, including even the Dark Phoenix saga. But we'll get into specific episodes.
Yes, we will. Fox Animation definitely stepped it up with their Marvel animated shows, with the X-Men in particular. But I would say that the Spider-Man, the animated series they put out at that time, really did that as well. Both shows did really good adaptations of the stories. I don't think there has been a show since those 90s cartoons that has quite captured the spirit and voice of the comics they represent. But X-Men, the animated series, is definitely more is the more beloved of the two series. And I think it's because of what you mentioned there. The X-Men stories really tap into the outsider, the misfit, and those who are discriminated against.
That's the strength of that show, I think. They got the emotional core of the comic. But eventually, the Lewalds decided on who the team was going to be. So they really leaned into the Chris Claremont and Jim Lee characters, which by then were still extremely popular and worked for the stories they wanted to tell. So you had Xavier and then Cyclops, Jean Grey, Wolverine, Storm, Gambit, Rogue, and Jubilee. Beast was a character they brought in for a small role, but they grew to love the character, and his role got much bigger over the course of the show. They also briefly added a character called Morph, loosely based on the Roy Thomas Neil Adams character called Changeling. In the first episode, Morph actually dies on a mission, echoing the death of John Proudstar in the comics. That moment really shook a lot of fans who didn't know the X-Men, especially since they did such a good job of making Morph a likable and fun character in the short time that they had with him. To this day, Wolverine's classic line, "This one's for you, Morph," is one that's remembered and loved by a lot of X-Men animated series fans. But that moment set the tone that X-Men the Animated Series was not going to be your typical cartoon, and it was going to deal with heavier stuff than most of the animated shows of the time did.
It definitely was not like your typical comic book cartoon. For being a Fox Kids show, it was pretty mature with its content. I don't know about you, but I have a hard time watching kid shows, and I don't feel like I'm doing that with X-Men the Animated Series even today. There is one thing I can say about the X-Men the Animated Series that I think is probably true for at least a fair amount of people, and that is the voice cast of the series defined how I heard these characters speak from then on out. I'm pretty sure that this was the first time we had ever heard the voices for most of the X-Men, so their voices just became attached to the character, at least in my mind. As far as voices go, Wolverine was Kyle Dodd, and to this day, when I hear Gambit's voice, I hear Chris Potter. I mean, I could mention Lenore Zann as Rogue or Allison Seeley Smith as Storm, but I mean, is that not true of the whole cast? I would liken it to Kevin Conroy as Batman or Mark Hamill as the Joker. The voices just became synonymous with the characters. Was it the same for you, Steve?
For me, it was a little bit different because I'd been reading the comics for years before the show came out. So I kind of had my own voices in my head for who the characters were by then, if that makes sense. But I will say that the X-Men animated series cast all came really close to what I was thinking. So they definitely did a great job on the casting. Kal Dodd absolutely is the kind of voice I think of for Wolverine, more than Hugh Jackman's, if I'm honest about it. Lenore Zann got the Southern Belle voice down really well for Rogue, and it's doubly impressive when you consider that she's a Canadian actress. I also want to mention the late Norm Spencer as Cyclops, who captures both the heroism and the stuffiness of Scott Summers. And nobody did Apocalypse like John Colicos. I still quote Pocky in that voice to this day because it was just that good. "I am the rock on the eternal shore. Cross against me and be broken." As an aside, you'll appreciate this, Mike. Colico starred in Star Trek, the original series, as the Klingon Commander Kor from Errand of Mercy. They all did so well, the cast members, that it's completely understandable if those are the voices that you hear for the X-Men. Everyone was just so good as those characters that it's hard to imagine anyone else in those roles now.
That is really cool about John Colicos. I did not know that. But let's talk about some of the episodes from X-Men the Animated Series. You know, they totally rehashed a plot point, albeit in a more elaborate fashion, from an episode in X-Men the Animated Series Season 2, Episode 3, called Whatever It Takes, in Wolverine the X-Men Episode 4, Overflow. In Overflow, we get to find out about how Aurora used to be a pickpocket for a man named Farouk, who turns out to be a powerful telepath named the Shadow King, and battles with Xavier as he tries to rescue Aurora. In both episodes, the Shadow King possesses Storm. However, in X-Men the Animated Series, He plans to use his new powers to essentially become a more powerful crime lord, and Storm forces him out of her body by flying so high that the lack of oxygen forces her to pass out, and thus Farouk is cast out of her. But in Wolverine and the X-Men, Shadow King convinces Storm that her village and the surrounding area is on fire, so she calls down a storm that opens the floodgates. However, it's Emma Frost who defeats Shadow King in that episode.
Both stories drew on the same backstory from the comics, which may explain some of it. The Shadow King was a villain that Claremont brought in a few times, and he was probably most notable as the villain of the Moor Island saga. But there was also a really great flashback issue from the Claremont Burn run, where Xavier meets Farouk and they have a telepathic duel. The bits with Storm's village borrow elements of a story called Life Death 2, where Aurora returns to Africa and helps to deliver a villager's baby. It sounds like the two versions play out a bit differently, but draw on the same elements.
So it was kind of a blend of stories that created those episodes. That's interesting. You know, X-Men, the animated series, is one that is beloved by both of us. And I thought it would be cool if we could list a couple of episodes that jumped out to us as favorites, and maybe we could compare our lists. I suppose one of the first ones that comes to mind is One Man's Worth, Part 1 and 2 from Season 4. While there was no Christmas involved, it had a sort of It's a Wonderful Life feel to it, with everything changing based on whether or not Charles Xavier is there to start the X-Men or not. He basically becomes a linchpin in time, where everything becomes a nightmare if he's not there. I will say that I thought that both Wolverine and Bishop were bullies in that episode, and were particularly bullying to an alternate timeline Forge, when simply asking him nicely would have sufficed. They threatened him and pushed him around. And just as a quick mention, I loved that Enemy Within play they did with Charles Xavier in the Phoenix Saga Part 2, where his evil half came out of him and attacked the X-Men. For those of you that are unfamiliar, The Enemy Within is an episode of Star Trek The Original Series where Kirk is split into two halves, each in their own body because of a transporter malfunction while beaming up from planet Alpha 177. One of the Kirks was good, but indecisive and ineffectual. The other one was evil, but impulsive and irrational. But ultimately, they were both two sides that Kirk needed to be whole. What would your first pick be, Steve?
One Man's Worth is a good choice, though I agree that Forge really got pushed around in that episode. That's an episode that the Leewalds have said that they enjoyed making, and it shows in that two-parter. It gets a little crazy with the time travel, but it's fun and it has emotional weight. And honestly, the little comic references are really good in it. Even Mimic, who's one of my favorite obscure X-Men, gets a moment early on. And I dig that they gave alternate Storm the 80s mohawk, not to mention that Storm and Logan are fun to see as a couple. So it's nice to see that, if only briefly. The Phoenix Saga in general is a high point for the show, and they did a great job in compressing 15 or so issues into 5 episodes, even if there were some changes here and there. The Dark Xavier thing was in the original comics, though, and they did a good job of fleshing that part out. Because let's face it, Charles Xavier has a really strong dark side, and he suppresses a lot of inner darkness. I think that's a big part of his problem, though it isn't acknowledged openly all that often. So stories like this and Onslaught bring that to the light, and it isn't pretty, and it's well done. But to answer your question, there are obvious episodes that tend to come back often in conversation, and those are all great, but as I'm a huge Nightcrawler fan, I want to mention Nightcrawler, which introduced Kurt Wagner onto the show. It's a smaller episode where Wolverine, Rogue, and Gambit go on a European skiing trip and hear about a demon in a German town. Gambit gets injured, and they get taken in by an order of Catholic monks operating out of an old castle. It turns out that one of the monks is Nightcrawler, who sought refuge there because they accepted Kurt for who he was. One of the monks is the villain of the episode, and he ends up inflaming hatred, and the X-Men have to deal with that. But the real heart of the episode is Kurt's friendship with Logan and their difference of opinion about faith. That, to me, is at the core of who Logan and Kurt are. They have philosophical differences, but they struggle with similar issues. The issue deals with faith without being preachy or coming off as ham-handed about it, and it's really well done. And the idea of a gothic adventure with monks is just a pretty cool idea. As an aside, this episode sure shows Kurt's past a bit and gives us a glimpse of Mystique, who is Kurt's mother. One really weird thing that never gets brought up much even in the comics is that Kurt and Rogue are basically siblings by adoption. Rogue is Mystique's foster daughter, but Kurt is her biological son. That should affect their relationship some way, but it's never addressed at all. But getting back to this episode, I like the way that Mystique is addressed, mainly through the art, as we see her shapeshift in her true form in the flashback. We know who she is as the audience, but the characters don't, and it's definitely handled.
You know, it's rare to see Logan philosophize about anything, much less religion. And I really enjoy conversations like that a lot. I'm reminded of like when Spock and Data had that whole discussion on what it is to be human. So good pick there, my friend. My second favorite episode was also a two-parter, and that was Time Fugitive Part 1 and 2. Oddly, one of the things I liked about it was that it really considered evolution in the process beyond just the mutated X gene, that the genes themselves would go through an evolution and that they needed to struggle to be strong enough to continue. In this particular case, they had to get the techno-organic virus in order to build the antibodies they would need to survive the next evolution. Add to this twist of fate that now Cable, a man who loathes Apocalypse more than anyone, must go back in time to help Apocalypse spread that virus, essentially working for his mortal enemy. In short, millions must die in the past so that future billions can survive. This gets extra interesting when you add Bishop to the story, because he has gone back in time to stop the virus. So you have two time travelers from different times and points of view fighting against each other. My favorite part was actually at the end, when we got to see what Cable's ultimate plan was in letting Wolverine get the virus. Because of his mutant ability to heal, his body automatically makes the antibodies against the virus, and therefore giving him the virus ensured that there would be a cure for the virus. That is just so hardcore and great writing, if you ask me. But what's your second pick, Steve?
Oh, that's a good choice. You really get some good stuff with the Cable and Apocalypse episodes, and that's a really great choice. But picking a favorite episode for me is a hard choice. I could mention the Dark Phoenix Saga, which to this day is the only on-screen adaptation of that story that worked. I can mention Days of Future Past or the season one finale or any number of things, and they'd all make sense. There are tons of great episodes on this show, but I want to point out episodes that are a little less obvious. So I'll go with A Rogue's Tale, and I love this episode on so many levels. As I mentioned at the start, the Leewalds were not up on every little detail of X-Men continuity when they mapped the first season out. This actually led them to making a rare mistake in the Muir Island episode. Rogue doesn't seem to know who Mystique or her Brotherhood are at all. This obviously wouldn't make sense because Rogue grew up around these people, and especially Mystique. But the Leewalds didn't learn about the Rogue-Mystique relationship until later in the process, so it was never mentioned or acknowledged in the episode. But here's the thing about the Leewalds that I really love. They could have left it there, and they could have said that this is their version not to address the issues at all. They didn't. Instead, they did an entire episode about the relationship between Mystique and Rogue, and then they explained the discrepancy. It turned out that Xavier wiped Rogue's memory in order to help her cope with her powers. They incorporated Rogue's past with the Brotherhood and the fact that Rogue trained Carol Danvers of her powers and her psyche permanently. The whole episode deals with Mystique wanting to get her daughter back, which ends up breaking down the mental blocks. The downside of this is that the ghost of Carol Danvers starts haunting Rogue, consumed with understandable rage over having lost her entire life. The episode is a really strong story, dealing with Rogue as she comes to terms with the family that she left behind and her guilt over what she did to Carol. Lenore Zann gives a great performance as Rogue in this one as well. I'll also add that the visual elements also really work, with Larry Houston brilliantly using the elements of a classic Jim Lee issue that dealt with Rogue's inner battle with Carol. The show made a misstep, but they owned it, and they used that setback to make a really great episode out of it, and I really respect the Leewalds for doing that. That was absolutely the right answer.
That is a very cool way to do that, and I think you made a good point. About 99% of the shows out there would never bother to do that. I think that says a lot about their commitment to both the established continuity and to the fans of both the comics and the shows with that decision. So if we could switch gears here to talk about the next animated show about after the X-Men, the animated series, and that was X-Men Evolution. X-Men Evolution ran from 2000 to 2003 on Kids WB, but it was re-aired on Disney XD from 2009 to 2011. X-Men Evolution ran for a total of 4 seasons, including 52 episodes, including 4 two-part episodes, making it the 3rd longest-running Marvel Comics animated series behind Fox Kids' X-Men that you just talked about and the Spider-Man animated series. The series essentially took Cyclops, Jean Grey, Nightcrawler, Shadowcat, Rogue, and a new original named Spike and made them teenagers who were students at the Xavier Institute for the Gifted. Others like Logan, Beast, Professor X, and Storm were teachers at the school. There they learned how to control their powers and use them for good. Although it should be noted that Rogue joins the Brotherhood of the Mutants originally in the 4th episode, but leaves them to join the X-Men in episode 7. Oh, and the Brotherhood of the Mutants was originally led by Mystique in the series, but it was later revealed that Mystique was being led by what she thought was a higher power, but turned out to be Magneto. But Mystique turns out to be quite the espionage thorn in the X-Men side. Apocalypse shows up, people leave the team, and new members are found and fought for. Honestly, a lot goes on in the series, and it would take a bit just to give you the highlights. But you get Bolivar Trask trying to create the ultimate weapon against the mutant with the Sentinel. And he even kidnaps and tortures Wolverine for research. The Morlocks, Asteroid M, the Juggernaut, the Super Sentinel, and so much more. While I did not watch the whole series, I was surprised at just how good it was.
That's cool. Now, I hate to say it, but Evolution didn't really appeal to me that much when it was on. I just feel like it departed a little bit too much for me. The idea of de-aging the X-Men and making them all teenagers was just a bit too jarring for me. I guess they wanted to take a different approach because X-Men the Animated Series was such a tough act to follow, and I guess that's fair. It just wasn't my thing. That said, I will say that I appreciate them making Kitty the focus, as she does work the best in that format, and Kitty's one of my favorites anyway. And I will say that Kurt is a fun character on that show too, but all in all, Evolution just wasn't the show that was for me, and that's fine.
I can see that. It was a bit, I was a bit taken aback by them de-aging them as well, but that series had some great stories in it, and that made up for it for me. But that about wraps up part one of our X-Men discussion. We'll be back tomorrow for part two, where we'll talk about the films and various other series that have come out. Until then, I'd like to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've enjoyed hanging out with us on ORP today. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to please share this episode and help us get the word out.
That is indeed a big help, and we want to thank you in advance for your support of both listening and sharing this episode. It means a lot to us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.